Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman.
Welcome to episode number 17 of Vashon 250, our look back on the last 250 years of America and Vashon Island. In the last few weeks, we've heard from a number of listeners who've expressed their enjoyment at our little program. In particular, there's a common theme in their comments that goes something like, "I didn't know that." So I'm glad we're educating people along the way. Here in episode 17, we will be discussing one of those very topics, the Olive Branch Petition. Even after doing our show prep, I still don't recall ever knowing about it, but it's an interesting point in our history. So put on your powdered wigs and tri-corner hats and let's get busy. Imagine a time when temperatures were running high and a desire for peace was at hand. In the midst of the Revolutionary era, the Olive Branch Petition emerged as an important attempt to reconcile the growing divide between Britain and the colonists. The petition was drafted in July 1775 by members of the Second Continental Congress, who had grown increasingly frustrated with British policies. We will be discussing the Second Continental Congress in our next episode. The petition was essentially a formal request for peace and expressed loyalty to King George III. It also addressed the various grievances held by colonists. The goal was to persuade George to consider these policies and seek a resolution that would avoid further conflict, thus returning both parties to a level of harmony previously enjoyed. Wishful thinking, I fear. The result was not the outcome hoped for by the colonists. King George rejected the petition, and in fact didn't even read it, and declared the colonies in rebellion and thus traitors. As you might imagine, the king's dismissal pushed many colonists even further toward the idea of independence. The Olive Branch petition serves as a lesson of the lengths people will go to seek peace, even in the face of growing tensions. It also reflects the complexities of the conflict between the colonies and the British during a pivotal moment in history. Ultimately, this effort was overshadowed by a series of events that followed, leading to the Declaration of Independence in 1776, and ultimately war.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think of King George III not only not reading the petition, but rejecting it outright, and then asking Parliament in August to pass a proclamation of rebellion, which was officially titled A Proclamation for Suppressing Rebellion and Sedition. I mean, you're talking about,
big deal here.
Yeah, big deal, and also punishable by death kind of things. So it declared the colonists traitors to the British crown. The proclamation actually had been drafted even before the petition arrived in Britain. The proclamation was then expanded in October 27th, 1775, in the speech from the throne, sort of the annual sort of address by the crown to Parliament, delivered by King George III to Parliament. So what you get is this sort of not only a rejection of the colonist sort of approach to try and create a peaceful resolution to these conflicts, but an outright rejection and basically claiming that the colonists were traitors and basically pushing the colonists to the point of having no option but to go to war. The importance of the Olive Branch Petition really is the sense that the colonists saw themselves as loyal British citizens. They did not want to break away from Britain, but because of the actions of the British government, they felt they had no option. And so the Olive Branch Petition is one of those last sort of gasp attempts by the colonists to say, hey, can we settle this?
Well, and as a side note, John Adams wrote a letter to the king before the petition arrived, and it was intercepted, and I think he did read that. And really, it was advocating for what the petition was all about. Let's see if we can find a solution to this before we blow everything up. And then the petition came and he wouldn't read it. So the decision had been made, basically.
Right.
So that's a critical point. It's a little bit of an art of diplomacy here. If we take that, like we have many things, and put it into, I guess that echo the failing attempt to reach a peaceful solution, what do we look at in the next century after that and then on up into today?
Well, in effect, if you look at the Olive Branch Petition as an attempt by the colonists to avoid war, what it does is really reflects an anti-war sentiment that's been very strong in the United States. And it becomes particularly strong in the late 19th century as America begins to expand into the world and become an imperial power in its own right. And so with the Spanish-American War, you get the formation in 1898 of the Anti-Imperialist League. I mean, this is an organization, and of course these are always, to a certain extent, fringe organizations, mm-hmm. but they represent an important voice of the American people who want to avoid conflict. And the Anti-Imperialist League was dead set against the Spanish-American War, and particularly vocal in their opposition to the suppression of the Philippines insurrection. Now, if you remember, with the Spanish-American War, America gains colonies for the first time overseas, and the Philippines is one of those significant colonies. And of course, as soon as America takes over the Philippines, there's an insurrection by Filipinos who want to be independent. And, you know, America sends in, troops to suppress this Philippine insurrection. And it becomes an early sort of example of what would happen, 60 years later in Vietnam, attempting to put down a civil war, if you will, within a country that becomes the possession of the United States. And it becomes a very brutal sort of war. America does many of the kinds of things in the Philippines that we later do in Vietnam. And you have a lot of opposition at home to this idea. Is America going to be another colonial power in the world? Or are we going to be, a beacon of democracy? And so the Anti-Imperialist League becomes an important voice for that. Not a major sort of political influence, but an important voice to the major sort of impetus of the United States to move out into the world and become a colonial power on the equal with Germany and Britain and Russia.
So if we jump ahead to 1916 and Henry Ford's idea of a peace expedition, let's talk about that.
Yeah, the peace ship, or the Ford expedition, as it's often called, was an attempt by Henry Ford at the beginning of World War One to sort of appeal directly to the people of the European countries, make appeal directly to the leaders of those countries to end the war. And he put together this peace delegation and chartered a major ocean liner, basically, to take them to Europe to negotiate personally with European heads of state. The slogan becomes, out of the trenches by Christmas and never go back. Again, noble sort of sentiments, but as one of the reporters, Burnett Hershey from the Brooklyn Eagle, traveled with this group, and he reported that the peace ship was made up of, and this is his quote, every crackpot and nut in the country wanted to get on the boat. from socialist to prohibitionist to anti-smoking crusaders to pro-German partisans and people from, quote, every religious splinter group in the country. I mean, so it becomes, like many of these movements, sort of a collection of discontents, if you will, of crackpots, if you will, but also people who truly believe that war is not the way to solve disputes. And of course, Henry Ford takes this group to Europe. You know, they visit all these heads of state. You know, they have talks with the governments, all of whom sort of ignore them. And it doesn't go anywhere. But it actually represents that strong sort of emphasis by the American people not to get involved with the wars in Europe. And of course, you know, Woodrow Wilson wins the 1916 presidential election by promising to keep America out of the war. And he does for a year, and then
he goes right into the war.
Yep. You know, so one of those sort of broken promises, if you will.
Which was repeated not all that long after in World War II.
Yeah, exactly. You know, another important sort of movement that emerges in the late 1930s is the moral rearmament movement. Frank Buchman focused on individual spiritual transformation, sort of a global evangelicalism, sort of this idea that we can rearm ourselves morally and sort of avoid war. He built it around what he called the four absolutes, which were absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. I mean, how can you argue against that? I mean,
that's what Rotarians do every day.
Yeah, you know, exactly. And yet the reality is, you know, moral rearmament began holding conferences on Mackinac Island, Michigan, in the 1940s. They were very anti-communist. They were tinged with pro-fascist and anti-Semitism. And so it becomes this sort of problematic movement in the 1950s to organize youth primarily to morally oppose war. But it doesn't go very far. And the same thing with the America First movement of the 1930s. This sort of attempt to keep America out of a growing war in Europe. And you know, important to remember, World War II really begins in the mid-1930s, right, when Japan invades China, and then begins in 1938, you know, with Germany attacking Poland. And so, you know, you have war going on. We often think in the United States of World War II beginning on December 7th, 1941. Well, the war had been going on for almost 3 years before that. And the America First movement becomes a very strong voice for America not getting involved in a conflict that doesn't involve the United States in Europe and in Asia. And of course, when we do get involved in World War II, it sort of changes that whole equation and looks at peace for the United States and protection of the United States is based on peace in the world. You know, and so out of that grows the post-World War II, what many historians call Pax Americana, this sort of peace that's imposed for almost 70 years after World War II with a Cold War that really very seldom turns into a shooting war. I mean, it does in Korea, it does in Vietnam, it does in a few other areas around the world. But it's really a period of incredible prosperity, incredible economic growth, and basically a peaceful world, you know, on the back of American military sort of strength.
So then if we jump ahead a little bit, well, it'd be about the same time, the America First Committee, we see it picked up by Pat Buchanan in the 2000s, and then by Donald Trump in a 2015 op-ed, which has been gone on from there. What do we do with that? I mean, it sort of keeps going, and now I don't know where we are at this point in time today.
Well, I think, you know, from my perspective, it's important to recognize that the voices opposing military intervention are important voices. they often get overshadowed. They often aren't heard. They often don't get to direct policy. But it represents a base within the United States who feels very strongly that war is not the answer to solving international disputes. You know, and that grows very strong in the United States in the late 1960s and early 1970s with the anti-war protest against Vietnam, particularly the 1967 march on the Pentagon, you know, where you have pictures of protesters putting flowers in the barrels of guns of soldiers protecting the Pentagon. But it's that whole sense that, you know, just because the leaders of a country take a country into a war does not mean that the citizens of that country necessarily totally support that war.
Well, and we're hearing more and more noise from retired military, retired generals, and even some that are still in service pushing back. And it'll be interesting to see what impact that has in the coming weeks and months and years.
It will, and an important part of that is the publication of the Pentagon Papers in 1971. Daniel Ellsberg, sort of releases the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. They're printed, become a bestseller.
Yeah.
In these thousands of pages. But what it does is it really undercuts the government's arguments for why we were in Vietnam, and really shows the sort of nature of an imperial power and how it works, you know, behind the scenes, works with clandestine operations. And the United States was involved in Vietnam in the late 40s and early 1950s, supporting the French. And so we're sort of locked into this, you know, war in Vietnam that we never wanted to be, but we're sort of the old tar baby sort of syndrome, you know. Once you're involved, you can't extract yourself from it. And so, all of these anti-war protests, you know, have some strength behind them in understanding the nature of how imperial powers work.
And so then we look at today, and we have Ukraine, and we're sucked into that, whether we want to be or not at this point. Gaza, you know, by virtue of our support for Israel. And then Iran.
Yeah.
And it all repeats.
It does. And what you see is in each of those cases, and then also in the cases of Desert Storm and the Iraq War and the Afghan War, you see protest groups on the corner of the four-way stop, weekends, waving banners, blowing horns, sort of mobilizing. And it's not the whole island, but it's a significant portion of the island who puts their bodies on the line, if you will, to say war is not the way to solve these problems. And so, you get that constant sort of development of a voice, a counter to the dominant government policy saying, wait a minute, we need to stop and rethink that. They often don't have the ability to make things stop.
No.
But it's a voice saying, wait a minute, there are alternatives. And that's what's significant in a democracy and in a country that believes in freedom of speech and the ability of people to say, to articulate their beliefs, whether they're in line with government policy or not. And that's something important for us not to lose as a democracy.
So if the diplomats who are negotiating things and driving these discussions would just listen to Vashon 250, we might be able to avoid some of this.
We might.
So you have in mind some Vashon events that sort of fall into this whole rubric and benefit from the olive branch model.
Yeah, I mean, Vashon, when you look at sort of the sweep of Vashon history, you know, from the late 19th century through the 20th into the beginning of the 21st century, you know, Vashon, all through the early part of the 20th century, late 19th, 20th century, up into the 1970s and 1980s, Vashon is a very middle America small agriculture community, sort of very little to stand against the government. A big deal on Vashon is when they vote for Roosevelt for president in the 1930s, first time Vashon ever votes for a Democratic presidential candidate. And then, after World War II, they go back to voting for Republicans again up until the 1980s. And so Vashon is a relatively middle-of-the-road, moderate, conservative place until the 1970s and 1980s. And that's what begins to change. And one of the first significant sort of things is in 1982, there's a significant anti-nuclear movement on Vashon. And they get 400 islanders to turn out. And this is when the island has half of the population we have today. Island has, 5,000-6,000 population in the 1970s and 1980s. To get 400 people out, that's like getting 1,000 out today.
Yeah.
It's important to put that in context. And they have basically an anti-nuclear peace march from Center to Ober Park. It's sponsored by the Vashon Island Peace Group. 2,600 islanders sign a petition from the Nuclear Freeze campaign to freeze the development of nuclear weapons. That's half of the population of Vashon Island signs an anti-nuclear petition. So, it's beginning of Vashon shifting from that sort of non-participation in national politics and sort of towing the line with sort of the moderate conservative sort of politics that dominates the United States.
Well, and that's especially interesting when we're, call it 250, 300 miles from the Hanford Nuclear Reservation,
yes,
which was still operating
for
defense purposes. And then you go the other way over here to the Kitsap Peninsula where there's nuclear missiles on the hillside to arm all the submarines that come in. Yeah. That's a big deal for us.
And I have a question too, Bruce. Yeah. Now, you said that was in 1982 that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
What year did the Nike missile base actually close?
The Nike missile base closed in the late 70s on Vashon.
So probably just a few years later.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. A few years before.
And unknown to most islanders, there were nuclear warheads.
Exactly. That's why I was questioning it.
At the
Thank
Nike
you.
Base.
Thank
but,
you.
But nobody knew that. At the time.
At the time. Right.
Just don't walk in that building across the street.
Well, it's not the building across the street. Oh. It's over at Paradise Ridge. That's where you don't want to walk into those bunkers. Unless you want to come out glowing.
Right? Yeah, there we go.
But yeah, and so it's worth thinking about every time in sort of modern Vashon history, since the 1990s, if you will, 1980s, 1990s, every time America has been involved in an international conflict, there has been a significant sort of outpouring from islanders to protest those. So Desert Storm in the 1990s, people gather at the four-way stop, and it's not all islanders by any means, but it's a significant portion of islanders. With the Iraq War and after 9/11, and then the Afghan War. Again, you see that outpouring of islanders saying, "Wait a minute, we don't need to be involved in these conflicts," particularly as they drag on. And then, as we get into more recent times, you begin to see these protests against the policies of the Trump administration with the support of Israel in the Gaza war and that sort of conflation of being anti-Gaza war with anti-Semitism. And I mean, that's a very thorny kind of issue.
Mm-hmm.
And even within the Jewish community on Vashon and in the United States, much less within the larger community. And so you get this sort of sense of how can people articulate their opposition to what's going on in Gaza without appearing to be anti-Semitic and yet opposed to the Zionist policies of the state of Israel. And it's a very difficult sort of line to walk.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Perhaps we need to get somebody in from the Havarat to talk about that.
But what you see is particularly in more recent times with the Trump administration beginning to become sort of what I would call a military adventurist administration with what's gone on in Venezuela, you know, what's gone on in Gaza, what's going on in Iraq and Iran, what's starting to happen potentially in Cuba, is you see Vashon Islanders organized, particularly through Indivisible Vashon, in creating a voice to oppose the actions of the current administration in becoming these kind of what I would call military adventurists in the world, going back to the tenets of the Anti-Imperialist League of the 1890s, who's saying the United States has no business being an imperial power in this world.
And that'll be an interesting, it'll be interesting to see how that all shakes out, given the history.
Yeah, and yet it's to me, it's always important to remember that Vashon, we may be on the periphery. We may be this island in the middle of the Salish Sea, cut off from Tacoma, cut off from Seattle, cut off from the what I would call the Pugetopolis of the yeah. Puget Sound region. And yet Vashon has a voice, and an important voice. And individuals on Vashon have important voices. And the creation of a forum at the four-way stop, if nothing else, for people to articulate their beliefs, to articulate their opinions, and to do that freely is an important part of what keeps us as a democracy. If we begin to lose that, we begin to lose the very nature of what it means to be a democratic society. And so as much as it bothers you when you pull up to the four-way stop, some joker's out in the middle of the street waving a sign and nobody knows when to go or when not to go, it's important to remember that if those folks aren't there doing that, then no one can do it. And if no one can do it, then we have no way of opposing or supporting the actions of our government.
Well, and to take that a step further, our Congresswoman, Pramila Jayapal, was on the island, I don't know, about a week ago now, and this is mid-April. And we had pretty much a full house at the Vashon Center for the Arts to hear what she had to say. Agree with her or not, there was still essentially almost a full house, which speaks volumes about our community. We do pay attention,
right?
Which is good. All right. So with that, we wrap up another episode. Next time, we will be joined by our good friend Craig Bellis, and we'll be talking about the Second Continental Congress, formed in September of 1775. So be sure to be with us. Thanks for joining us.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.